WS2N, KQLIW, what's Curiosity doing? You got it, Glenn. Paul.
This is WS2N. Yeah, I think they said 48U on that black hole. So that puts it out, like you said, past Pluto, around Neptune. That was another report. They're about even right now, I think, Pluto and Neptune. So that's, you don't want to go near that thing. The event the horizon is probably, you know, maybe 100 AU, I guess, out. I don't know. Yeah, Dick, I wanted to bring up the commercial space race. You know, we always cover NASA. Well, you know, NASA's part of this, too. I mean, they are handing out money to these companies to get started. And there's one right after the other. You know, SpaceX, we talked about that a lot with their Dragon spacecraft and their Falcon launch rocket and a couple of the other ones. There's like about five of them. And that is another one that just joined a group. And this one has got some ambitious ideas. In fact, I had to check out, I had to go to the NASA site to see if it was true. Find these things on the internet. I used to like the magazines, but you do have to be a little careful when you look for information. But NASA confirmed this one company, Golden Spike, the new name for a company, and they're naming it after you know, the transcontinental railroads. You know, the Golden Spike. Now this company, run by a reputable guy, this guy Alan Stern, who was a former director of NASA space missions, a lot of the space missions that they had, now in the private sector doing this. He has plans on sending people to the moon using a lot of existing equipment. The Dragon spacecraft might be involved. When you have people on board, definitely the Falcon launch rocket that Dragon has is involved. He would take some of the existing hardware and utilize it, and he wants to send people to the moon. The only question is, they need to have a company to develop a lander. So he came up with, this just the other day. They've been looking around. They want to go with Northrop Grumman to develop the lander, just to design it. Let me drop it, WS2N. Now, why Northrop Grumman? Well, on Long Island, we know that Grumman was the builder of the LM, which put six of these spacecraft on the moon and built a few more, including the one that really saved the Apollo 13 crew from disaster. They used it as a lifeboat. That one didn't make it to the moon, but it did a better job of bringing them home. Well, Northrop Grumman is now going to design this thing, and who knows, maybe eventually they'll build it for them, the Golden Spike. Now, get how they're going to do this. Now, they want to do this by the turn of the century, that's 2020. You're looking at maybe 8 years away. I have a lot of problems believing they can develop a lander and qualify it for only 8 years away. But a lot of the other equipment is pretty much built. The Falcon launch vehicle by Dragon is built. So what they want to do is they want to use the Atlas V that NASA has. That's the heavy lift vehicle that NASA's using right now. And they want to launch an call it a lunar transport vehicle. The word amounts to the gigantic booster. Let me drop it. So step one would be to launch the booster into Earth orbit, and then they by a NASA Atlas rocket. Then they would take a Falcon SpaceX rocket and launch an unmanned lander, you know, modern day version of the LEM, put that into Earth orbit. And these two things would dock, and they'd actually refuel and have a refueling tank up there, and that would go into translunar injection, and those two things would go to the moon. Now there's no crew on board. That's what they want to do. Put the lunar lander into lunar insertion. Now this thing is now in orbit with nobody up there. The phase two part of this is they want to launch their crew. They'll take the Atlas V, the same Atlas V that put the other LTV up there, the lunar transport vehicle, put that into Earth orbit, take another Falcon 9 launcher made by SpaceX, and put the crew in that. Looks like two people. I've got a lot of problems with just sending two people, but that's what he wants to do for now. It looks like two people would launch from Earth, and they would go into orbit and again dock with the LTV. The LTV would then launch itself and the crew to the moon to eventually meet up 3 or 4 days later, going into lunar orbit and docking with the lunar landing vehicle that's already now in orbit. We drop it. Now this complex system is almost over, Dick, so the lander now goes down to the moon with the two people, and the other vehicle is still in orbit to come back with, you know, with the crew. Crew spent time on the moon, similar to the Apollo days, and they launch, they meet back up with the crew vehicle for transport back to Earth. Naturally, they leave the lunar landing vehicle in orbit. I guess that eventually deorbits and crashes into the moon. And off they go back to Earth and get rid of this big fuel tank in the back, this LTV. They'll get rid of that, and then they'll just have an Apollo-style craft. Either be it the Dragon version or maybe something by Boeing. Boeing's in the middle of building a vehicle that would be able to do something like this. They call it the CST-100, Crew Space Transportation. 100 stands for 100 kilometers. So, you know, when you get to 100 kilometers, it's really being designed to go into low Earth orbit, but who knows, maybe they'll develop it to become part of this system. So now you've got this new company, Golden Spike, joining the other private companies in the corporate space race, SpaceX, Boeing. Boeing has hardware. They plan on launching people by 2015, only 3 years away. Drop it. Or Nevada. They have the Dream Chaser. They want to put their spacecraft again on top of an Atlas V NASA rocket to go up to the space station. You've got even another company called Blue Origin. They want to have their own manned spacecraft. They just did some testing with theirs. They proved out their pusher emergency rockets to pull the spacecraft away from the launcher in case there's a problem. They just did that about a month or two ago, successfully. And, of course, Orbital Science, they were supposed to launch their Antares rocket from Virginia over in Wallops Island. Last month it didn't come off, so I guess they got some problems. But maybe this month, and definitely by April 5th, they intend on launching their Antares rocket and an unmanned Cygnus rocket to the space station. A lot going on in the space world, corporation-wise. Let me drop it. And NASA, of course, is still developing their Orion spacecraft. That's the one that's many years out. I guess they have a manned test version probably coming up in 2018 or something, where it will of the Orion spacecraft launched by the SLS, the Space Launch System. That's the one that's bigger than the Saturn V rocket. Still under development, but NASA's working on their end of it. You've got all these companies pushing to really pick up the slack. Hope they get somewhere. Back to you, Dick. WS2S.
Exciting sounding stuff, Paul, but I've got a little bit of a problem. You make it sound like each of these competing companies are putting forth an effort to put man on the moon, and the best reason I could put a man on the moon is to do prospecting, to investigate soil composition, soil versus depth, acoustics, presence of water, and whatever. We got this beautiful vehicle roaming around Mars right now called the Mars Science Laboratory, or the Curiosity. And it's giving us a lot of bang for the money, and it's, with its nuclear power supply, it's good for some number of years. And it can tolerate some very high temperatures and low temperatures. The lunar surface near the equator gets to extremely high, intolerable temperatures at high noon on the moon, and half a month later, at midnight on the moon, it gets to extremely cold temperatures. And with rare exception, you can't put a human being there. You and I could design a machine that could tolerate that, but not a human being. Let me drop. So to get the best bang for the dollar, I would build a Mars Science Laboratory-like thing, land it on the moon, let it roam all over the place looking for diamonds and carbon and water and uranium or whatever you want to look for. And it can stay there for a long period of time. You put a human being there, it's 1,000 times more difficult to keep the human being alive throughout the mission, to supply him with all the consumables while he's there, and he can't tolerate the temperatures. I mean, during every one of our Apollo lunar landings, you put him at a certain portion of the moon that's halfway between high noon and sunset, so that he had proper temperature for the couple of days that he was there. And if he stayed too long, it would get too hot and so on. So I see a lot of disadvantages of sending the moon, and not enough advantages, and a hell of a lot more cost than this, and risk involved. So I'm kind of curious as to why they haven't decided to first send mechanical things in order to decide what is valuable by which you send a man later. I like manned missions, but are you getting your money's worth on this one? WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay, well, at this particular company, Golden Spike, is going to be doing it for a profit. They believe they're going to have paying customers do this. So, that's their motivation is money. And the same with the other companies, except the other, this last company, Golden Spike, is the only one I've heard that really seriously plans on sending people to the moon. There was another one about a year ago. I think they dropped off. They came out of Europe. The other ones that I mentioned, SpaceX, Orbital Science, and all of those, Sierra Nevada, they plan on making money by collecting money not only from NASA to resupply the International Space Station, but from other companies, satellite work. Let me drop it. SpaceX already has contracts for private satellite launching. So it's all money motivated. But the whole thing is economics. Do I agree with you? Yes, I would send a million Mars missions, more missions to the moons of Jupiter and Saturn and all of that. Although that is going on, I would do more of it. The problem is, where does that money come from? The public wants to pay for exciting things in the public's mind, it's manned missions. And everything else is secondary. You wouldn't have the Pioneer spacecraft or the Voyager spacecraft or even the Viking spacecraft that landed on Mars back in the 70s if it wasn't for the manned space program. Drop it. Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs, and the 400,000 people behind those three programs, and the money generated and all was terrific. I mean, it really kept a good part of the economy going for a decade or more. But when they pulled the plug on Apollo, after Apollo 17, you know, there was a planned 18, 19, 20, and even a 21 mission that was canceled. They had hardware built, ready to go. And the money eventually started to shift. There was momentum, not only with the money, but they had all these corporations and companies doing this stuff. And they came up with these robotic missions to Mars landers, to orbiting spacecraft around Mars. You had Pioneering and Voyager dropping blisters around the sun. These were all expensive missions that were really built from the momentum of the money that was generated from the manned space program. I don't think any of those programs, I mean, eventually it would happen, but if it wasn't for the manned missions, I think the science missions, the real good science that we got, as time went on, eventually you had the landing craft, Huygens, that landed on one of the moons of Saturn, on Titan. All the science that you gained from all of those missions, I think, outbeats any manned mission that you possibly come up with. In fact, you think WS2.
Okay, I think you're telling me that private funding is going to support this. Each person that wants to visit the moon, got a rough guess as to what the price of that ticket is, for WS2N, KQRIW?
I guess I don't know if it was the NASA site or maybe space.com or one of the other ones that was talking about the Golden Spike Company. $1.5 billion investment to get this done. But the cost, I don't see how they're going to recoup. They were only talking about maybe 20 flights during a 10-year period from 2020 to 2030 or so. I don't see how they're going to do it. You know, again, I have a lot of problems with this. Sending two people alone, I think they could kill each other by the time they get to the moon. They did a lot of psychological studies when you put two people in a closed space for a long period of time. They really thought that out for the Apollo missions, and they said, you know, we have to have three people. Three people get along better than two. Simple things like that, I think this guy's either going to have to cancel the whole program or he's going to have to build it up a lot bigger than what it is. I mean, just to send two people all the way to the moon and back, I think it's a bad idea. Back to you, Dick.
I'm having some trouble with the mathematics here, Paul. The Apollo space program was around $33 billion in 1969 money. You're saying these guys think they can do it for $1.5 billion, which is almost two orders of magnitude, yeah, less. They must really know something to make it that cheap, to make it 100 times cheaper. If each individual ticket was $1.5 million per ticket, and you want to break even with $1.5 billion of investment, you've got to send 1,000 people. The mathematics just doesn't look right. Are you going to charge each of these people $150 million per ticket? What do you think, Paul? WS2N, KQRIW?
Yeah, I was looking for confirmed ticket prices. too. I couldn't find it. Well, at least I found confirmed prices. SpaceX, he had a speech in Europe a month or two ago. He wanted to send 80,000 people to Mars at $500,000 a blast. So, and that's only one way. You're not coming back. He wants to colonize Mars. That I found ticket prices for, but I couldn't find one for the moon. But this is all too new. In fact, I can't even confirm it with two people. They did say two people somewhere. I think it was on the NASA site, but kind of vague. I would go with four, but it's true. They did do studies with the three-man crew would be a lot better than a two-man crew. So I mean, these private companies are doing things a lot cheaper. There's one company with the retro rockets, the pusher rockets succeeded. I mean, they're way down in cost once they get their flights up. I mean, it's going to be like one-tenth the cost. Yeah, $30 billion was the estimated cost for the entire program, the entire 10-year program. Mercury, Apollo, and of course, Gemini, and all the support equipment that went by. Let me drop it. The vehicle assembly building, and all the different buildings down in NASA, down in Cape Canaveral. Total cost was $30 billion. So, you know, the cost of, like, the SpaceX to launch the Falcon rocket, I mean, it's dirt cheap compared to what you would have thought, you know, a Gemini spacecraft would have cost. Maybe even, I don't know, I think I saw 10% or something, or some very low number that this guy, Elon Musk, is doing it for them. I wouldn't be surprised. You know, they're going to use a lot of existing equipment. They're going to really rent out the Atlas V, which is a built rocket by NASA. Use that for two of the launch vehicles to get this done. Drop it. SpaceX, they've got Falcon rockets. They've already launched three of them. They're going to, involve them, put up their TLVs. The only thing that they have to build, the company, and they have to get, something built, is a lunar lander. And they'll probably get that out of Grumman. Northrop Grumman will probably be the manufacturer of it. That's my guess. They've already contracted them to design it. If they're going to design it, they'll probably build it. And probably, a very low cost. I think they could get it done for $1.5 billion there.
Okay. I'll give you the $1.5 billion with all the current knowledge. But still, to make that a paying endeavor with enough customers and enough money at each customer, and they're going to have to put a down payment on the ticket ahead of time. Wow. Got a guess, Paul, as to how soon this is moving and how likely it is to really happen? You got any personal guesses on this? Back to you, Paul, K2RIW.
They said one report was 2018. I mean, that's only 6 years away. I doubt that. Maybe they can make 2020. And the figures that you said, I think you said $1.5 million a ticket to go to the moon. I think you went by it. That went by my head a little too quick. No, it would be way more than that. To give you an idea, to launch a space tourist, the first guy was Dennis Tito, up to the space station for, 7 days or something. It was $20 million. $20 million to get that seat. And now the price went up. It's up to like $30 million. I think the Mars Shuttleworth there. South Africa paid about that much. Probably this girl that's going to be going up, the singer. She's going to be going up this year. But these are $30 million tickets to go to low Earth orbit. And you can imagine what it's going to be to go to the moon there.
Whenever you look at any of the NASA news on these civilians that buy the ticket for $20 or $30 million, there's very little of that in the news. They're kind of quiet about that, aren't they, Paul?
I think they're quiet about it. All the space reports. I mean, they, you know, I mean, it's all over the internet. If you look, magazines, people can afford to buy them anymore. But I mean, it's not a, you know, you don't see it covered on Channel 2, 4, even CNN. I mean, CNN buy the whole science staff. They got rid of Miles O'Brien, and I don't think you were a big CNN watcher. You didn't have cable or something at the time, but Miles O'Brien was just terrific. They got rid of him and the whole science staff. They concentrated on politics. I think it's hard, very hard to come by. I remember going to work and saying, talking about the space show and, you know, what they were doing, and, you know, they were maybe sending out a tethered satellite or something. And they would say, you mean the space shuttle's still going up? People didn't even know. People don't care.
It's kind of old news. We were getting very glazed over responses of the public by the time you had Apollo 16 and 17. And so the public enthusiasm, other than the disaster of Apollo 13, was kind of low. I think that's one of the reasons it got discontinued. We had already beat the Russians. We had picked up a whole lot of pounds of lunar soil. I'm going to take a lot of time analyzing all of that. And so each future mission was, I don't know the exact number, maybe another $1 billion, maybe $2 billion. And so what do you get for your money is an interesting question. This day in history is an interesting one. 175 years ago, 1838, Mr. Samuel S.B. Morse and Mr. Alfred Vail gave the first demonstration, successful demonstration of a telegraph in Monmouth, New Jersey. No, Morristown, New Jersey. So 175 years ago today, Morse code was created, as I say it. They just said a first successful public demonstration of telegraph. So here we are, ham radio-wise, 175 years later. Very happy about that. Anybody got any comments on this one? K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay. Of the guys who went to Ham Radio University today, what did you guys see? What did you like? What could be improved? And so on. Give me some call letters if you're willing to give us a little bit of description. Because I slept through it all with running nose and coughing and everything else, but I mostly slept through it all. So what did I miss? Give me your call letters and name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You missed Channel 12 being there. I didn't go, Dick, but I saw it on Channel 12 News.
Okay, describe what you saw on Channel 12 News. How long? What were they showing you? Who did they interview? Give me some words on this, Paul. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, it was only a couple of hours, you know, before the net, so I should have taped it. You know, they run the news every hour, they'll repeat it. So you could probably tune it on tonight, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, you'll see the same report. And so if anybody's got a DVR, hit the button and give us a better report next week. They showed it. Well, I saw my radio. They had a close-up of a Kenwood 440. Pretty sure it was Kenwood 440. It went by pretty quick, but it looked like mine. And they did interview at least one guy. And his name went by quick. I didn't get it. Didn't get the call letter. So we'll have to see. But they talked about and Ham Radio University being there every year. They do this every single year. I thought somebody was going to talk about Hurricane Sandy or something with amateur radio, but nothing was said about that. Back to you, Dick.
Roughly how long was the Channel 12 News presentation? I'd like to believe there's eventually going to be a YouTube video of that. What do you think, Paul?
I guess so. I don't know. There's a YouTube on everything now. Somebody will probably do it. Maybe somebody listening to us now will hit the DVR and set it up for YouTube. By the way, I don't know how to do that. Interview, I don't know. The whole report was 1 minute long, which is a lot for any TV news report. A lot could be said within that 1 minute.
KC2. Victor Charlie Charlie. Start with your name, and then tell us what you saw. K2LIW. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. My name is Kathleen. Victor Charlie Tango. I'm calling from Westchester. We spoke, I think, last week or the week prior. I thought it was very good. I've never been to any ham thing before, so I was happy to see that, to do that. You know, I got to learn some things. I thought there was going to be an opportunity to buy something, so I need this piece so that I can not be working off a rubber duck antenna. And so I was disappointed about that. I didn't know there wasn't going to be any vendors there, but that's right. And I was really looking forward to meeting you people that I hear all the time on the radio, and I didn't get to meet anyone. I asked at your table a couple of times, but nobody seemed to really know where anybody was.
Very fine. You've traveled down from Fleetwood, New York. I can see where you are. Airline miles, you're 27 miles from me. So a reasonable trip from the Yonkers area is where you traveled from. Too bad when you asked for particular people, you didn't find anybody that you normally talk to. I'd like to believe most of the people who are somebody will be wearing a tag which gives their call letters and name. Most of those guys do. Quite often I go to a thing like this and I go incognito. I don't put a name. I've had some fun one or two times when I go to this thing, Kathleen, by going to a conference, and they ask, are there any questions? And I'll ask a question and or say that, you know, I heard them on the TechNet say so-and-so. And the moderator will say, yeah, how do you know that? And I have fun giving that answer. But I'd like to believe if you knew who you were looking for, wonder how long you've had your license. And so, have you been listening to the TechNet for a while? And was there a good-sized crowd? Did you, when it comes to the list of conferences you go to, did the list have a couple of subjects that interested you? Give us a couple more words on that, Kathleen. KC2, Victor Charlie Tango, K2LIW.
Yeah, there were some things that interested me just because I'm very, very talented in learning all this stuff. So I listen to you a lot just because even though I don't necessarily get to apply the stuff, I just hear it enough that eventually, you know, I kind of get what it is. But, numbers and all the stuff, the technical stuff isn't my forte, shall we say. But, learning about the antennas, and, I went to the Echo Link. We had him in Westchester, but again, just not knowing what half of the stuff is, it takes like three times to hear it just to make some sense out of things. That was good. What else did I see? I thought that there were a lot of classes that were interesting. I just, went to the ones that were, that I could at least apply. Since I only have NHT, I don't get the GDX or any of the other stuff.
I can understand how you'd be a little disappointed that there were no vendors by which you could buy batteries and rubber duck antennas and handy talkies and antennas and so on. To my knowledge, this is the 14th annual Ham Radio University, and it's intended to be 95% educational and 5% face-to-face meetings, eyeball meetings. I may have the ratio wrong, but you know what I mean. So it's non-commercial per se. From Limark's point of view, I am guessing they say, hey, we've got a flea market in the spring, the summer, and the fall. So there's lots of times when you meet vendors at a landmark event, and this is intended to be purely educational. I think that's the philosophy. On top of that, to set aside enough space in that particular facility, Briarcliff College, for all the vendors. In the wintertime, putting vendors outside is not so comfortable. There may not be enough room inside to have all the lecture halls plus all the vendor spaces and all the insurance to require all of that indoors. So I am guessing that's got something to do with it. Okay. So kind of sad that I thought last night I was going to go, and as the night progressed last night until this morning, my cold got worse and worse. Alrighty, as I promised you guys, I'm going to give you a little bit of a lecture on Transformers, triggered by what Wesley asked 2 or 3 weeks ago. Wesley's original question was, if I'm building a one-to-one transformer, where the primary winding and the second wire winding has the same number of turns, how do you know how many turns? Should it be 1,000? Should it be 100? To the average person looking at a transformer for the first time and knowing a little bit about it, you think the most important thing is the turns ratio. If I'm trying to take a transformer in the old days from 120 volts input, and I'm running the 12-volt filaments of my vacuum tubes, I want the transformer to give me 120 volts on the primary winding, 12 volts on the secondary winding. One of the questions we learned in the questions pool is that the turns ratio determines the voltages. So that's a 10-to-1 voltage difference. So if there's 10 times more turns in the primary than the secondary, then 120 volts on the primary gives you 12 volts on the secondary, and it works. Okay. Everybody thinks the turns ratio is the first thing you consider. Once you learn a little bit more about transformers, you'll find out it is the third or fourth thing you consider. Third or fourth. Way down the line. There's much more important things you got to consider. And let me show you how I ran into this. I'm a sophomore electrical engineering student at Pratt Institute. I had studied some circuit courses where they told me about inductors, capacitors, resistors, impedance matching, and all this kind of jazz. The transformers were not really going to be covered until you got to rotary machinery, which was either a junior or a senior course. So I hadn't had the right course yet. But I'm building this thing called a 6-meter synthesizer. I wanted to build a very accurate frequency synthesizer. The word synthesizer wasn't really popular in those days. This was a 1960 time frame. So I'm building this transistorized, very accurate circuit, and I needed a 12-volt power supply at about 1.5 watts, 2 watts. And so you couldn't walk into Radio Shack those days. It wasn't Radio Shack, Arrow Electronics, and buy a 12-volt output transformer by which you would rectify and make a 12-volt power supply, regulated 12-volt power supply. That transformer didn't exist. But I'm in the radio and television repair business, and I had often used audio output transformers. The final audio tube in that television set of 1960 had something like a 6W6 or whatever for a final tube capable of generating something like 3 or 5 watts of audio. It went through a transformer. The primary impedance on that transformer was probably something in the vicinity of 1,500 ohms. And the winding on the secondary went to the 4-ohm loudspeaker. So that transformer transformed the voltage swing of the plate of the audio output tube of the television set. It gave you the couple of watts of audio that went to the 4-ohm loudspeaker. Let me drop. And if that transformer is a good one, it goes down to 60 hertz and up to 6 kilohertz. So I picked up one of those audio output transformers, and just for the heck of it, I plugged it in the primary winding into the 120-volt line, and everything was hunky-dory. The voltage I got out of the secondary winding was a little bit too low. It just whined some extra turns on the secondary winding, got it up to 12 volts. To this day, that 6-meter exciter, synthesized exciter of mine, still has that audio output transformer in there as a power transformer. Didn't know how to design a transformer, but there's one. I picked up what I had. What the smart amateurs will do is they say, I can write a check and buy the thing I need. That's the expensive approach. I can decide for educational reasons I'm going to find somebody's schematic diagram in the ham radio amateur radio handbook or a QST magazine. And nowadays, you go to DigiKey. In those days, you went to Lafayette Radio or Arrow Electronics, and you bought all the parts. And then you start putting it together. Let me drop. Nowadays, you do it with DigiKey. That's one approach. The third approach, the really smart amateurs that are very crafty, look in their junk box and pick up everything that might go into a power supply that runs on a 110-volt line. Transformers and filter capacitors and rectifiers and so on. Take everything you got out of the junk box, put it on the table and say, can I design a circuit around this? And half the time you can. And within a couple of hours, you've got a working circuit using your particular junk box, making modifications of somebody else's schematic. Your particular pass transistor happens to have a little bit more power, it's a little bit bigger, but it does the job and so on. You make compromises and make changes in various places. That's the way the really crafty hams do it. Use whatever junk box stuff you've got, okay? It wasn't until my junior or senior year where they really gave me all the equations that go into transformer design. After taking those courses and walking out of that school, I thought I had a lot of the foundation information about transformers. But did I really have useful, practical information where I could walk into a laboratory and tell the technician, okay, take this particular iron core, take 26-gauge wire, wind 1,000 turns on this primary and 100 turns on that secondary in order to make a 12-volt circuit transformer. Could I do that? The answer is no. Of all of the approximately 100 college graduates that throughout my whole 50, 40-some-odd year career in electronics as an engineer, of all the 100 or so students that I have interviewed, two very striking things have come out. Number one, because I'm such an antenna enthusiast, I would ask each one of these brand new graduates, how many kinds of antennas do you think there are? I got answers that range from about 15 to 50. Some guys think there's only 15 kinds of antennas. Many of the other students...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Many of the other students were led to believe there's as many as 50 kinds of antennas. Having worked for 40-some-odd years in the antenna design field as a consulting engineer on antennas, I can tell you with reasonable authority, you open up the fourth edition, Volakis is the author, of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. And depending on how you do the counting, you'll find approximately 5,000 kinds of antennas. Essentially, every student coming out of school doesn't know how to design one, doesn't know how many there are, doesn't have a vague idea. Almost all of those students coming out of a good electrical engineering school, maybe with a master's degree, very few of them could design a transformer. Of all the people who have signed into this technical net over all the years, if I had to point to somebody who I know could design a transformer from scratch, KC2QIQ and WY2U, those are about the only two guys who I would go to with some confidence that could do that. Transformers are very useful, and yet the way it's taught to us and the way antennas are taught to us, there's a hell of a difference between the schooling and the way it's practiced in the real world. And very few of us feel comfortable with it and could really do it and have the experience. Let me go. So from a purely heuristic point of view, I'm going to give you my version of transformer design. You're not going to read all of these little secrets that I'm going to give you. It's not in any book. This is my way of doing it. As you can tell, on that particular synthesized circuit where I needed a 12-volt power supply way back in 1960, I cheated. I went and took an audio output transformer, somebody else's working circuit, because I had a bunch of them in a junk box, and I rewound the secondary winding to get enough voltage out of it. It worked like a charm. Because the volts... the power I needed was around 1.5 watts, and the transformer was good for 3 watts, and the primary was happy with 120 volts. Okay. I'm about to design a transformer, and someone has told me that for this particular design, you probably ought to use 1,000 turns in the primary. I'm going to start off with that and then find out if it's right or wrong. And I realize that there's a certain diameter of the copper tube that I'm going to wind the wire on that's going to be the primary of the transformer, and then I'm going to be plugging in these EI laminations to put the actual iron in there for the magnetic field to make the transformer. So I find out that I'm going to put 1,000 turns, and I make a rough guess on the back of an envelope. That's going to take roughly 10 feet of wire to do that. All right, 10 feet of wire. I lay it out on the floor, on my wooden floor, 10 feet of wire. I very carefully put my ohm meter across it, and I might measure something like 1 ohm. And I know darn well that if I plug that wire, that's going to be the primary, if I just, without winding it in a transformer, I plug it into the 120-volt line, 1 ohm on 120 volts would be 120 amperes. That would be something like 2,400 watts would be dissipated by that wire. The wire would probably last for about 2 seconds, glow red hot. I've laid it across the wooden floor. I'm going to have this great big scorch mark on the floor where I laid out the...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So because I measured... Let me drop it. So because I measured my ohms ahead of time, I'm smart enough to know, don't do that. Okay? The next thing I'm going to say is that every piece of wire has some inductance to it. A very rough rule of thumb that gives you into the ballpark is every piece of wire you'll likely use is around 22 nanohenries per inch. All right, 10 feet of wire is 120 inches, and you multiply that out, and you come up with something in the vicinity of 3 millihenry, if I did the mathematics right. 3 millihenry at 60 cycles is going to have something like 1.1 ohm of impedance. No, 2 microhenries, there it is, 2 microhenries. 2 microhenries at 60 hertz is only going to have a milliohm, so the inductance of the wire, a milliohm of inductance, but an ohm of resistance means that 99% of that wire's impedance is the ohms. And I don't want to put 2,400 watts into that piece of wire. Okay, I now know that the wire is going to be wound into a coil. And then once the coil has got more inductance, you take any wire, you wind it into a solenoid coil, multi-layer solenoid coil. I could wind it onto the copper tube, and when I did that, I might come up with 3 millihenry of that air-wound coil. 3 millihenry's now got a inductive reactance. Inductive reactance equals 2 pi FL. 2 pi, a constant, times the frequency, 60 hertz, times L, inductance in henry. You multiply that out, I'm guessing it would be in the vicinity of 3 millihenry, 1.1 ohm. So I got 1.1 ohms. When I wind it into a coil, I got 1.1 ohms of inductance and 1 ohm of resistance. You go through the mathematics of that. You put 120 volts across it. Instead of dissipating 2,400 watts, you're going to be dissipating 1,000 watts. And you're going to burn up your wire real fast. I ain't going to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So as you can see, what I'm doing here is I'm step-by-step taking the raw ingredients that's going to go into a transformer, and I'm finding out what would happen on each one of the steps. And the highest priority when you design a transformer is all by itself, the primary has to work. Everybody thinks the turns ratio is the highest priority. Uh-oh. That audio output transformer that I was going to use, that when I load it down on the output, I'm going to get 1.5 watts of 12 volts out of it, and the input current on the primary side is going to be some number of milliamps at 60 cycles, 120 volts. And when I don't load the secondary, I'm feeding nothing but the primary, only a couple of milliamps of inductive reactance is drawn by that primary. It sits there and is very happy. The highest priority when you design a transformer is the primary all by itself must work. If you don't have that, don't even bother winding a secondary. And so far I've been telling you about how much heat I would create if I take the wire laying out and put voltage on it, if I take the wire and wind it into a coil that's going to be the primary and put voltage on it, in both of those cases, I'll burn up the wire real fast. But now the next step is I know there's going to be iron in there. So I take my EI laminations and I start putting them inside of that copper tube that contains 1,000 turns of the primary winding. I did that primary winding, by the way, by starting off with a nice rectangular piece of wood that I put in my lathe. My lathe turned it very nicely. It held the copper tube in just the right position. As I carefully wound the wire on there, it was nice, neat wiring, and 3 or 4 layers of wire, 1,000 turns. So now I remove the wooden mandrel. I start plugging in the EI laminations. And I was smart enough to choose iron that has a permeability of 1,000. The particular iron laminations I chose, permeability of 1,000 means that magnetic field will flow through that iron 1,000 times better.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The magnetic field will flow through that iron 1,000 times better than it will through air. Relative permeability of 1,000, that's what that means. I chose an iron, relative permeability of 1,000. So I had roughly 3 millihenry of the solenoid coil on the copper tube before I added the iron. Now my iron with this permeability of 1,000, rough rule of thumb, the inductance of the lining is going to go up by 1,000. 3 millihenry times 1,000 is 3 henry. 1,000 turns on the primary. Once I insert the EI laminations of the core of this transformer, the iron core, I've now got 3 henry of inductance on that primary. And I thought I had written it down here. What happens with 3 henry? I think the answer is 1,100 ohms of inductive reactance. Yeah. So I put 120 volts across that transformer with that 3 henry winding on the primary. Now the transformer will draw a primary current of, I guess it would be something like 1/10 of an amp, 100 milliamps, a very reasonable amount of current. Maybe the 1,000 turns is quite enough. Now, why does that happen? Why does the iron do that? You could call it Faraday's law. When I've got 1,000 turns, and I'm going to put, let me round off the 120 volts to be 100 volts, so mathematics turns out easy. Assume that Con Ed today puts 100 volts of AC, 60 cycles, into the socket in my wall. And I'm putting 1,000 volts across, I'm putting 100 volts AC across the 1,000 turns. That means each one of the turns has 1/10 of a volt across them. Let's just talk about that first turn of the transformer, of the primary winding around that core. That first turn, with 1/10 of a volt across it, it does, by Faraday's law, sets up a magnetic field. That magnetic field is encompassing the primary winding, every one of those turns of the primary winding. The 1/10 of a volt I've applied to the first turn creates, by transformer action, by Faraday's law, by the magnetic field changing, the next turn of that primary winding generates 1/10 of a volt all by itself, even before I apply anything to it. I could apply 1/10 of a volt to only the first turn. I could tap into the turn and do that. The next turn alongside of it would also have 1/10 of a volt by transformer action, by Faraday's law. Every one of those turns, every one of the 1,000 turns, would have 1/10 of a volt across it. You could call that back EMF. That gives you some explanation for why, when the iron is there and the whole number of turns are there and you've got the right amount of inductance, very little current is drawn by the transformer. Call it back EMF. Call it inductance of the total winding. There's 2 or 3 different ways you can analyze that. When I start putting a secondary winding on there, each turn of the secondary winding is also going to develop 1/10 of a volt in my example. Choose the right number of turns on the secondary winding, and I can get any voltage that I want within reason by transformer action. And once you start putting a load on that secondary winding, you're now starting to restrict the amount of magnetic field that's existing in the core. The amount of back EMF on each one of the turns of the primary starts decreasing.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And now the current on the primary goes up. As I start loading down the secondary, the current goes up. Because my secondary loading is starting to decrease some of that magnetic field. And therefore there's not as much back EMF. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is conservation of energy. I'm putting a certain amount of energy into the primary. I'm getting a certain amount of energy out of the secondary. It's by way of a magnetic field between primary and secondary. Therefore, I've got to increase the energy I put into the secondary, into the primary. Conservation of energy. So far, we've now figured out some of the steps you might go through if you are, with limited knowledge, starting to build your own transformer. The exact amount of inductance you get to the winding when it's in air or the winding in iron, you can put it on a RLC meter, you can put it on an inductor, resistor, capacitor meter, you can put it on a network analyzer. You can put it across a 12-volt transformer with a 1-ohm series resistor and look at the voltage on your oscilloscope. There's lots of ways you can measure the inductance of the winding to find out what's really going on. Okay, so far you now know, why do I put 1,000 turns on the primary and not 10 turns? In theory, 10 turns on the primary and 10 turns on the secondary is a 1-to-1 transformer, but so few turns on the primary, and by the way, inductance is a function of number of turns squared. You go from 1,000 turns on the primary down to 100 turns, the inductance of your primary goes as a 10-to-1 ratio, it goes 100-to-1 ratio down, and now just the magnetizing current feeding 120 volts AC into nothing but the primary is going to be a big number, and it might burn up that winding, even with the iron core there. So your first priority in a transformer is, does the primary work? Then you start worrying about the secondary. There's one last thing that I didn't tell you about. Let me drop. In this particular example, I've got 1,000 turns in the primary. I developed roughly 3 Henry of inductance in that primary with 1,000 turns when the iron is installed. And the iron has a relative permeability of 1,000. The magnetic field flows through the iron 1,000 times better than it does through air. That's the beginning. There's another catch. That permeability of 1,000 on the iron is true if and only if you don't go above a certain magnetic field. Every piece of iron, you start making the magnetic field stronger and stronger, it will eventually saturate. It can't accept any stronger magnetic field. You can try to put one there, and it says, the heck with you. I'm not going to let that happen. It becomes a short circuit when you go beyond the maximum magnetic field that that particular piece of iron, what's the maximum magnetic field that iron can tolerate. Once you've gone to the right manufacturer, he told you it's got a permeability, relative permeability of 1,000, he will also tell you in his data sheet, when he drops, what's the maximum magnetic field it can tolerate. In this particular transformer that we're sort of designing in our head right now, with 1,000 turns in the primary, 3 Henry in the primary winding, it's probably more than good enough at 60 cycles as a viable transformer, as long as the maximum magnetic field of that iron can tolerate. And there's ways of calculating that, a little bit more complicated. However, what happens if I design the transformer for 60 hertz, and I'm right at the threshold where the iron doesn't yet saturate, and I ship this piece of electronics over to Japan or to England, where they run on 50 hertz? In order for the exact same voltage, assuming I'm going to a country that uses 120 volts AC, but 50 hertz, take my word for it, as the frequency goes down, the amount of magnetic field for the exact same number of turns goes up. You're now, the positive half cycle of the 60 cycle or 50 cycle voltage dwells there longer. The rate of change of magnetic field determines how many volts you get on each one of those turns, the back EMF, if you want to call it that. When I go from 60 hertz down to 50 hertz, the positive half cycle, the negative half cycle of that power supply from the wall dwells there longer. I'm asking for the same rate of change of magnetic field for a longer period of time on each half cycle. I'm asking for a larger amount of peak magnetic field. If I exceed that number on that particular piece of iron, and it saturates, a transformer will hum very loudly, start making a ratcheting noise, start running real hot, start making a non-sinusoidal waveform, and there's a chance it'll burn itself up. I ran into that problem. Let me drop. There's a very respected company in New Jersey that made power transformers for the spectrum analyzer I was working on as the design engineer of that particular spectrum analyzer back in the 70s. The AIL 707 spectrum analyzer, and that transformer was rated for 50 hertz and 60 hertz. We had built a whole lot of those spectrum analyzers with that transformer in that power supply. Everything's hunky-dory until we started shipping those spectrum analyzers over to Japan, one of our customers. And he started complaining about the loud singing noise, the heat that was coming off that transformer. As the transformer saturated, it made strong magnetic field, external magnetic field. That external magnetic field took the cathode ray tube circuit and started making the pictures on the screen dance all over the place. So there's some strong disadvantages. And we found out that the manufacturer of the power transformer in New Jersey